Well, good morning, everyone. One thing I think to mention is that the Gary Petty and his two daughters will be headed to the airport, probably maybe even headed there now. So I'm sure they would appreciate prayers for a safe, uneventful journey. I know that, as he told us before, they have quite a trip ahead of them, quite a number of hours to be in a cramped airplane. So hopefully they'll make the best of it. I'm sure they will. I'm sure there's plenty of conversations that they can catch up on with the father and daughter time they're going to have. So anyway, it's good to be here. I knew that I was coming up to a sermon this week, and I wanted to talk about why we eat unleavened bread, but Mr. Petty took care of that last time he spoke. So I'm sitting there mentally thinking, okay, well, that topic is off the list for the Sabbath during the holy days. And then Russ got up here and started talking about the wave sheaf, and I started to get scared because that's actually what I want to talk about today, is about the wave sheaf. We're going to talk about that and go through that. In preparation of that, though, there's some information we need to cover, and I hope that you'll stay with me through that. It's a little bit of technical information about some of the offerings that are offered in regards to this time of year. I also wanted to mention that we just happen to be in the same time frame as the original events that occurred in the book, in the Gospels. Essentially, we had a Wednesday Passover. We have Christ being resurrected later this afternoon, and as Russ mentioned, the wave sheaf offering tomorrow morning. Hopefully, as we're going through these days, I know we're only, 3 days in, we're considering the unleavened bread, the purpose of it in our lives, of focusing on putting sin out. I'm sure many of us, with this new culture we have of working remotely, we don't have as many temptations as we used to have when we would be going into the office every day during these days. We're most of us, I'll say, not all, but most of us are in a way more controlled environment where we don't have to worry about that. But we still have the focus. We still have the focus of eating unleavened bread, putting out sin, trying to put in Jesus Christ. And let me just make a note. I want to get the time on this so I can see how long we go. I don't want to keep you all too long. I want to make sure we get the lunch. And my watch is trying to talk to me. Wonderful technology. In any case, Christ called himself the bread of heaven. And his acceptance by God on the wave sheaf as our perfect offering, or actually on the cross, was foreshadowed in a special offering that God commanded be given after the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread, the wave sheaf offering, as we've already mentioned. Before we read about this particular offering, I would like to cover some information, and some of you have heard this before, some of you haven't, about the types that are presented to us in the offerings. Mr. Petty talked about this in, I think, both of his sermons, and I like the way that he covered it, is that we have these types that are given to us throughout the Bible that all point to a greater anti-type. They all point to Jesus Christ fulfilling these types. And the types are there to show us all the different ways that Christ's offering was presented. Let's talk about some of the offerings that are laid out for the nation of Israel in Leviticus 1. We'll start in Leviticus 1. A lot of the information is coming from a book called The Law of the Offerings by Andrew Jukes. And as far as I can know, that's still available. I actually checked it, and it is still available on Amazon. If you'd like to pick up a copy, it's like $10 for a copy of the book, and it's well worth it. if you want to dig into this topic a little deeper. Leviticus chapter 1, if I can find it. Went right by it. Leviticus 1, in verse 1. Now the Lord called to Moses and spoke to him from the tabernacle of meeting, saying, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when any one of you brings an offering to the Lord, you shall bring your offering of the livestock, of the herd, of the flock, and of the flock. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer it of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. He shall kill the bull before the Lord, and the priest, Aaron's son, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around on the altar that is by the door of the tabernacle of meeting." So we see here this offering, this first offering was discussed as a burnt offering, and they're described as bringing a sweet aroma to God. We have a worshiper coming, an accepted worshiper coming to wholly surrender himself to God. Christ appears to us in this offering as the man bringing to God something that is most precious to him. Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 2 refers to this type of this offering, this burnt offering. If you go over to Ephesians, keep your finger over in Leviticus. Ephesians 5 verse 2 talks about this burnt offering and how it was seen by God. Ephesians 5 and verse 2. And we're breaking into the thought here. Paul writes to them, "And walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma." So Paul is referring back to the type of offering where we just read about, a burnt offering that was given to God. It was something that was seen as being delightful in God's eyes. The way he walked, the way Jesus Christ walked and lived, pleased his Father immensely. Now, this sin offering was not described as having a sweet-smelling aroma. So this verse in Galatians is actually, or Ephesians, is referring to Christ fulfilling the types presented to us by the burnt offering, the later description of the meal offering, which was grain, and then the peace offering. All of them were described as being sweet-smelling savors to God. These were not offered for forgiveness of sin, even though in verse 3, as it says in verse 3 of what we just read, it's being offered of one's own free will. Now, speaking of the use of the word, you'll notice in verse 4 that it does say to make atonement for him. And here's what Jukes writes about this word. I'll quote from Andrew Jukes here. Quote, "The word atonement here, as elsewhere, in itself means simply making satisfaction. And satisfaction may be of two sorts, depending on that which we have to satisfy. We may satisfy a loving and holy requirement or satisfy offended justice. Either would be satisfaction. The burnt offering is the former. The sin offering is the latter. The atonement of the burnt offering is the satisfaction that God receives from the perfectness which the offerer presents to him. It involved the offering of a life. Life was given, something that from the very beginning God claimed as his own. So here is a picture of what we owe to God, our duty to him. And the offering in the body of Jesus Christ is seen as fulfilling that duty to God, perfectly keeping the first four commandments. This offering was wholly burnt on the altar. The whole animal was burnt up. This showing us a picture of our relationship with God that just doesn't involve committing one part of our lives. As Russ just talked about, we have a covenant that involves all parts of our lives. It's the complete surrender of everything to God. The next offering that described in Leviticus is the what's called the meal offering, or the meat offering, I think is what it says in the King James Version. This offering has the imagery of man fulfilling his duty to fellow man. And the way that that's presented to us is that an offering was brought of grain or ground up meal, and the priest would take a part of that offering and burn it. But the rest of that offering was eaten by the priest and their family. So they received satisfaction from this offering. They were able to eat of the ingredients. Note the ingredients of this offering. This offering is ascribed to us later in chapter 2 of Leviticus. The ingredients included flour, oil, and frankincense. And each one of these is a detail that's brought out of how Christ fulfilled this sacrifice with his life. The fruits of the ground are given. As I described, the fruits of the earth are something that satisfies our fellow man. It's something that we need to live. The importance of this difference between the burnt and the meal offering is this. God claimed life as his. And in the burnt offering, he represents what man owes to God. The fruit of the earth is given to man and represents what we owe to each other, to our fellow man. Those are the two types that we see in these two offerings. In the meal offering, the gift of corn and oil represents the fulfillment of our duty to our neighbor. God tells us in Leviticus 19:18, "You shall love your neighbor as yourself." The idea of this meal offering is that a man surrendering himself to God is a sweet aroma so that he may be able to serve his fellow man. Now, one of the last offerings described by the book of Leviticus is the sin offering. And as we already talked about, this was not a sweet-smelling savor. This was to satisfy guilt. And let me just quote from Andrew Jukes, his description on this offering from page 137 and 138 of his book. "But here in the sin and trespass offerings, we read of sin in connection with the offering." So we read of a sin that causes this offering to be brought. "Here we see confessed sin, judged sin, sin requiring sacrifice and blood shedding, yet sin atoned for, blotted out, and pardoned. The sin offering shows that sin has been judged and that therefore the sense of sin, if we believe, need not shake our sense of safety. Sin is indeed here preeminently shown to be exceedingly sinful, exceedingly hateful, exceedingly evil before God. Yet it is also shown to have been perfectly met by sacrifice, perfectly born, perfectly judged, perfectly atoned for." So that sin offering fulfilled all of those aspects of the offering that Christ made. With that background, with that understanding of the various types that are given to us in the offering, let's go look at the wave sheaf. Turn with me to Leviticus 23. Leviticus 23. And we'll begin in verse 10 of this chapter. This is where all of the holy days are listed. Interestingly enough, if it ever comes up at work, I was thinking about this because my manager was telling me that somebody asked him where Eric was on Thursday, and he told him he's keeping the Passover. He's not here. And so I thought, well, if I needed to give them like a complete list, I could just give them this chapter, Leviticus 23. It'll give you the complete rundown of what all the holy days are. Of course, they might get a little confused about this part. Leviticus 23 and verse 10, "Speak to the children of Israel and say to them, when you come into the land which I give to you and reap its harvest, then you shall bring a sheaf of first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted on your behalf. On the day after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it." And they understood this to mean tomorrow, the Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. And you shall offer on that day, when you wave the sheaf, a male lamb of the first year without blemish. Now notice this. They offered with this a burnt offering, a male lamb of the first year, and its grain offering shall be 2/10 of an ephah of fine flour mixed with oil, an offering made by fire to the Lord for a sweet aroma, and its drink offering shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. Notice we're not told of anything here about a sin offering being presented. Just a burnt offering with its grain offering. Both of these, as we've just heard, were types pointing to Jesus Christ's sacrifice. The burnt offering represented Christ satisfying God's requirements. It was wholly consumed by fire. While the grain offering represented Christ satisfying man's claim on his fellow man. As only a handful was burned and the rest eaten by the Levites. And no necessity for a sin offering, as the wave sheaf represented Christ in perfection being presented to God. Let me read that again. The wave sheaf represented Christ in perfection being presented to God. So there was no sin offering required. Let's go on in verse 14 of Leviticus 23. You shall eat neither bread nor parched grain nor fresh grain until the same day that you've brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, from the day you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. So the wave sheaf offered early on Sunday morning after the Sabbath during unleavened bread pictures the resurrected Jesus Christ being accepted on our behalf before God the Father. He is the antitype or fulfillment for this wave sheaf. In Colossians 1:18, if you want to jot this down, I'll read it. Colossians 1:18 reads as this, and he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence. And over in 1 Corinthians 15:20, we read this, but now Christ is risen from the dead and has become the firstfruits of those who have fallen asleep. So how many people look at this, so they read this, and I know many have, and I've done this too, where you look at this and you think, okay, so this is a wave sheaf. This is a bundle of grain, you know, maybe a bound-up bundle of grain that's brought into the temple and waved before God. That's how it starts out. But that is not actually what is waved in the temple ceremony. The word sheaf is actually translated from the Hebrew word omer in this passage. And omer is equivalent to a little over 2 quarts of barley flour. So here is what happens to get that omer ready to be waved before God. First, let me quote from the website BibleTools.org's article on the wave sheaf offering. And this is concerning the timing of the cutting of the wave sheaf. Quote, though Scripture specifies the day the wave sheaf was to be cut, it gives no specific time of day to cut it. Jewish history from the Second Temple period gives an interesting insight. The second century Mishnah affirms that when the Sadducees controlled the temple, the sickle was put to the grain just as the sun was going down on the weekly Sabbath. The book Biblical Calendar states, the Bothusians, or the temple priest, reaped the first fruits sheaf at the going out of the Sabbath. So around the time that Christ was resurrected and coming out of the grave, the barley that was to be used the next morning for the wave sheaf offering was being cut. Now let's look at the method used to prepare this omer, or sheaf, for the offering. From the book The Temple, Its Ministry and Services by Alfred Aldersheim. I apologize for so many quotes, but I just wanted to get this information to you. Stay with me. I know this can be a little bit dry, but I hope you find it interesting. A quoting from the book, when the time for the cutting the sheaf had arrived, just as the sun went down, three men, each with a sickle and basket, formally set to work. But in order to clearly bring out all that was distinctive in the ceremony, they first asked the bystanders three times each of these questions. Has the sun gone down with this sickle into this basket on this Sabbath? And lastly, shall I reap? Having each time been answered in the affirmative, they cut down barley to the amount of one ephah, or 10 omers, which is equal to about 3 pecks and 3 pints of our English measure. Though one ephah or 10 omers of barley was cut down, only one omer of flour was offered in the temple. Here we see the barley grain was cut down on Saturday evening. The grain was then roasted and ground into fine flour to be presented as the omer or wave sheaf offering the next morning at around 9 a.m. Even the preparation of the offering points our mind to Jesus Christ, toward the fiery trial he endured at the hands of the Jewish people and the Roman administration. The intense beating that he endured is brought out to us in this type, pictured by the barley being ground into flour to be ready to be presented to God the next morning. Christ told Mary when he met her in the garden on Sunday morning that he needed to ascend to his Father in heaven. Let's go to John 20. John 20. And we'll read this verse. John 20 and verse 17. This is one of the first encounters we read that Christ spoke to Mary. She thought he was the gardener, as we read in the previous verses. And finally, she recognized him, and in verse 17, he tells her, "Do not cling to me, for I have not yet ascended to my Father, but go to my brethren and say to them, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, and to my God and your God." Christ had not yet ascended to be accepted on our behalf. Christ is the true bread from heaven, fulfilled the types in this offering as he presented himself before the Father as the omer to be lifted up. Fine flour, unleavened and perfect. Let's look at a couple passages about Jesus Christ in reference to the manna that God sent. And this story is instructive because we hear about this concept of an omer. John chapter 6 and verse 48. John chapter 6 and verse 48. We'll start in John, then we'll go back to the Old Testament. John 6 and verse 48. These are not unfamiliar verses. I'm sure I think we've heard these multiple times during this season. John 6 verse 48. I am the bread of life. Your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness and are dead. This is the bread which comes down from heaven, that one may eat of it and not die. I am the living bread which came down from heaven. If anyone eats of this bread, he will live forever, and the bread that I shall give is my flesh, which I shall give for the life of the world. So he tells them this bread, this manna that came for ancient Israel, was a miracle from God. It was truly bread from heaven, but in their physical state, they died. They still died after eating that bread. Let's go back to Exodus 16. Exodus 16, we'll read about this bread that God sent to the nation of Israel. Exodus 16, we'll start in verse 11. I got to remember that our digital friends, namely my wife, telling me to give you the verses so she can punch it on her little device. I do the same thing. Exodus 16:11, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, I have heard the complaints of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat. So they had been complaining about the lack of meat. So he says, I'm going to bring you meat. And in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God. So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. Take a moment and sometime go look at a commentary and look at some of the calculations people have made of how much meat this had to be to feed the nation of Israel. How many quails had to be brought to feed all these people? And in the morning, so it was that the quails came up at evening and covered the camp. And in the morning, the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew lifted, there on the surface of the wilderness was a small, round substance, as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, what is it? For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, this is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord commanded. Let every man gather it according to each one's need. One omer for each person. According to the number of persons, let every man take for those who are in his tent. Then the children of Israel did so and gathered some more and some less. So when they measured it by omers, he who gathered much had nothing left over. He who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need. Isn't it interesting that Jesus Christ describes himself as the bread of life that has come down from heaven, comparing himself with this manna, which when they gathered it, as described in Exodus 16, an omer was sufficient for each person. Then in the wave sheaf offering, what was offered? An omer of barley flour was raised up before God, symbolizing again that Christ's sacrifice was sufficient to satisfy God to atone for the sins of this world. He is presented to God as the first fruits of the dead, the first omer of a mighty harvest yet to come at the return of Christ. We have all been called now to be part of that early spring harvest. The season of the grain harvest was used by Jesus as a metaphor in his preaching. There were two major harvest seasons in Israel: the grain harvest in the spring and the fruit harvest in the autumn. The spring harvest, which started with barley and ended with wheat, took place between Passover and Pentecost. Pentecost is also called the Feast of First Fruits because the season begins and ends with an offering of the first fruit harvest. The first was barley, the second was wheat. Christ used this as an analogy in many of his parables, an analogy of saving people, of harvesting lives, of harvesting people. Let's go to Matthew chapter 9. Matthew chapter 9. Matthew 9:35. We'll start verse 35. Matthew 9:35. Then Jesus went about all the cities and villages, teaching in their synagogues, preaching the gospel of the kingdom and healing every sickness and every disease among the people. But when he saw the multitudes, he was moved with compassion for them, because they were weary and scattered, like sheep having no shepherd. Then he said to his disciples, the harvest truly is plentiful, but the laborers are few. Therefore pray the Lord of the harvest to send out laborers into his harvest. You and I are a part of that harvest that Christ is gathering now. We are part of the spring harvest that is the early harvest of first fruits. The wave sheaf was the first of the first fruits to be gathered. Once it is presented to God in the temple, the barley harvest began. This wave sheaf offering presents us with another picture or type of the perfect offering that Christ presented to God on our behalf. It's also identified as the starting point. And Russ mentioned this, the starting point for counting 50 days to the next holy day, the Feast of Pentecost. In this way, God is making a connection in our minds. He's connecting this season of the year, Passover and Unleavened Bread, with Pentecost. We begin counting starting from tomorrow. Leviticus 23, verse 15. Leviticus 23 and verse 15. Leviticus 23, verse 15. And you shall count for yourselves from the day after the Sabbath, this year, that's tomorrow, from the day that you brought the sheaf of the wave offering, 7 Sabbaths shall be completed. Count 50 days to the day after the 7th Sabbath. Then you shall offer a new grain offering to the Lord. And you shall bring from your dwellings 2 wave loaves of 2 tenths of an ephah. They shall be of fine flour, and they shall be baked with leaven. One of the few times an offering was presented to God with leaven. They are the first fruits to the Lord. So we're told to count 50 days. This offering is called an offering of first fruits. Again, we see these in being fulfilled today, as we are among the first fruits being offered to God. The Jews referred to this period of time that we're entering as the counting of the Omer. They actually have on their calendars, and I actually have one that I get a calendar that has the Jewish months and days printed on it. And during this time, they actually do have a little note of what day of counting the Omer you're in as you go toward the Feast of Pentecost. They feel it was intended by God to have our attention drawn to that so that we would be focused on keeping his laws as we approach that holy day that many believe is associated with the giving of these 10 commandments. In this way, we're tied between, we have a string, essentially, that's leading us from these holy days to the next holy day. We're to be ever mindful of that day that's coming, that day of Pentecost. We do this even in our tradition with the Feast of Tabernacles. I know we don't put in what Omer day we're on in the bulletin, but we do put in how many weeks it is to the feast, right? The Feast of Tabernacles is, and I don't know when that begins. Jane's not here to ask, but I think sometime before she begins to print how many weeks to the Feast of Tabernacles, reminding us of that next holy day. For us today, Christ is reminding us that his plan for us doesn't stop with our redemption from sin, with Christ's sacrifice. And I know we've heard this in many of the messages that we've heard during this season. It doesn't stop with that sin offering. Our deliverance from spiritual Egypt and the removal of sin from our lives, we must continue that process. We continue that to the next holy day, which pictures for us the pouring out of God's Holy Spirit, his Holy Spirit, the power to fulfill that new covenant inside of us. God's purpose for his people cannot be completed without this essential ingredient. God's command to count toward the next day was designed to draw our attention to the next step in God's plan, to show us that we are just beginning here. We're beginning with the Passover and the Days of Unleavened Bread. And we're moving forward. We're moving toward the Feast of Pentecost. The spring holy days, which begin with the barley harvest during the Days of Unleavened Bread and end with the wheat harvest on Pentecost are designed to remind us that we are first fruits. We are part of that harvest that God is doing right now. From the Pentecost that was celebrated by the early church in Jerusalem to the day that Christ's feet touched the Mount of Olives at his return, Christ and the Father have been focused on gathering the early harvest. That early harvest that will lay the groundwork for the later great fall harvest. As we come out of this period of focusing on putting sin out of our lives, let's now begin to focus on putting God's law into our minds as we approach the next feast, the Feast of Pentecost.